Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome back to Well That Aged Well. And this week, we are perhaps going to discuss one of the most controversial topics of late antiquity, and that is, of course, the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. And I'm here today with Brian Ward Perkins. And what do you think comes to mind? And I want to, before we begin with that, I want to begin with, of course, to get the elephant of the room just right away, And I want to begin discussing, of course, the legendary series by Edward Gibbon, and the same title as this episode, called Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. So what's still, though, is still kind of irrelevant today. People still read them, are still influential in books, but even not about the Roman Empire. So what is it about the influence of Gibbon that persists to this day?
Okay, well, I mean, Gibbon, for a start, Gibbon writes beautifully. He was amazingly knowledgeable. He knew his text, and it's a book that is thoroughly readable, which cannot be said about many modern historians' books, which tend to be rather dull. Gibbon aimed his book at a scholarly but also a general audience, and that's why it was so successful, and also because it was just so ambitious. His ideas are, as it were, discredited today, or one could say out of fashion. I mean, he attributed the rise of Christianity as a key factor in the decline of the Roman Empire. That isn't fashionable today, and I think rightly so, because the East Roman Empire, which persisted, became more and more Christian and actually did extremely well. So I don't think, you know, Christianity. But Gibbon, I mean, he had a decent argument. I mean, he argued that the church was overprivileged, it was undertaxed, that lots of good people who should have been doing something more useful went into it, and that it, you know, didn't pay its way in terms of providing troops and taxation. It's not a very strong argument, mainly because actually the church in the 4th, 5th century, which is the key century, wasn't hugely well endowed. The great endowment of the church really sort of happens slowly through the 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th centuries. And it's really only by the 8th, 9th century that the church owns massive quantities of land. So I think, I mean, Gibbon, I think one can discount his theory, though, like all theories, it will probably come back in some form in the future, because, I mean, people go on debating what happened at the end of the Roman Empire. There is no firm, clear, indisputable answer. So it'll probably come back in some manifestation.
And of course, we're given in the famous chapter 15, we are going to start at, of course, Constantine's conversion. And that's where I want to be. This is just the of how did the empire change under Constantine. Of course, we are going to mainly focus on the western side of the empire this episode, but as I said, the Eastern Empire would last for thousands of years. But of course, what did it mean for the western half when Constantine moved his the capital city to Constantinople, and you have, you know, away from Rome, and of course the Christianization of Europe?
Okay. Well, Constantine didn't actually move everything over to Constantinople. He established a second important city in the east, Constantinople, which he named after himself, and he gave it exceptional status. He established a Senate there, I mean, previously the only Senate was in Rome, of course, but he ruled the empire as a single structure, just using two capitals together. And in the 4th century, sometimes the empire was united, sometimes it was divided in two for functional reasons. I don't think one can attribute the decline of the West to the fact that everything moved east. I mean, it's true that in the 5th century, when the West was in trouble, the Eastern emperors sometimes intervened, but sometimes didn't because they had more pressing problems on their hands. But everybody imagined the empire to be a single force and not a divided thing. So I don't think the establishment of Constantinople was absolutely crucial. And as I've said before, the conversion to Christianity, I don't think made any difference in terms of the power structure and the resources that were available to the emperors.
How quickly did paganism fall from the Roman Empire? Because we discussed this in previous episodes as well, that people were still pagans, and a lot of the pagan, I think that was to make it easy conversion, right? That a lot of pagan themes were converted into Christian traditions, right? And it was kind of a smoother
Yes. Yes, no, the
the
process of
Christians.
conversion was a classic top-down but unenforced conversion. What happened is the emperor became Christian, which was a remarkable fact because, I mean, there was no reason why an emperor should become Christian. And crucially, Constantine established a dynasty which was also Christian. The people, the person at the very top of the empire was a Christian. This meant that he favored people who were Christian, and people at the top echelons of the empire drifted into Christianity because it was advantageous to them. And then people lower down similarly drifted into Christianity because their superiors had become Christian. It was a very gradual process. There was no massive effort to Christianize people. It's not the case that they sent, missionaries out in the 4th century. It's a drift. Very similar, actually, to the later conversion of large parts of the Eastern Empire to Islam. It's not the case that the Muslims sent out missionaries in order to convert the local people. People just drifted into Islam. And similarly, in the 4th century, they drifted into Christianity. And there was no, I mean, only at the very end of the 4th century is there any legislation against pagan practices. I mean, in fact, arguably, it's the most effective way of achieving a conversion. You don't, if you try and force people to become something, they become martyrs. I mean, which is what happened, when the pagans tried to make the Christians comply. I mean, if anything, it made them more bloody-minded. So it was actually quite an effective way. I mean, they weren't thinking about it, but it just, but the empires just moved slowly into a new religion.
Well, the battle, because a little bit later, of course, the Battle of Adrianople in 364 to 378, and where the Visigoths come in, is this a significant part of the contribution to the decline of fall, the Battle of
Oh,
Adrianople?
if we're talking about the fall of the Roman Empire, and one of the things that's very important to note is that the 4th century empire, up until the Battle of Adrianople in 378, was very powerful. It had periodic problems, but it was a united, strong empire which kept the people that they called the barbarians at bay. And in fact, the 4th century empire had pulled together a chaotic situation in the 3rd century. In the 3rd century, almost the whole of the West and East had been overrun by people from outside, and it was only the heroic efforts of people like Diocletian that pulled the empire together again. So, in fact, in the earlier 4th century, one was witnessing the resurgence of a powerful military empire. But, I mean, people obviously we'll go on discussing whether things had changed for the worst in some way, whether there was some degree of economic decline. And economic decline would affect an empire like the Romans because, like us, they've had a professional soldiery. And so, as it were, the amount of tax you raised would then determine how many soldiers you had, exactly as in the present day. But there's no obvious sign of economic decline. Christianity, we've already dealt with as not obviously leading to a weakening. Personally, I think it's largely bad luck, because the Romans and the people that we call the Germanic barbarians, the people who are east of the Rhine and north of the Danube, were always quite finely balanced, the balance of power. The Romans, for instance, had attempted under Augustus to advance the frontier across the Rhine towards the Elbe, but Varus, the commander, lost three legions, and that was the end of attempts.
Varus, give me back my legions.
That's right. That's what Augustus is supposed to have said on his deathbed. Varus, give me back my legions. So the Germanic people could win. And in fact, in the 3rd century, they very nearly overturn the empire. So I don't think there's a particularly, I mean, the Romans had much better organization. They had much better provisioning. They had fortresses. They had military armament factories. They were better, but not overwhelmingly so. I mean, if one thinks of, the 19th century and Europeans facing, foes in Africa, it's nothing like that. They're much more finely balanced. And what happens at the end of the 4th century is the Germanic world is upset by the arrival of a new people, the nomadic people, the Huns, who come in from the east, from way east in Asia, and actually drive the Visigoths, certainly, and probably many of the later people at the beginning of the 5th century, though it's hard to prove that, westwards into the empire. And in doing so, they also force those people into a degree of unity, which they didn't normally have, because these people are on the move. They're in serious trouble. They, as it were, kind of unify. And that's, I think, it's just bad luck. I mean, but the Roman Empire was going to fall sometime. I mean, crucially, the Eastern Empire was very, very lucky because the Germanic people didn't have sea power, or at least not until the 5th century, when the Vandals acquire some sea power in Carthage. And crucially, they were unable to cross the Bosphorus. So most of the Eastern Empire was not affected in any way by the Germanic people coming in across the Danube and across the Rhine. And that meant that the Eastern Empire could always draw on its taxation resources and its military resources, and in fact, eventually repel the barbarians, whereas the Western Empire didn't have that geographical advantage, except for the advantage of the Straits of Gibraltar, but those are then crossed in the early 5th century. I mean, I think it was, I mean, my explanation is that essentially the Germanic people and the Romans are quite finely balanced, and that balance just happens to tip slightly in favour of the Germanic people. I think it's as For me, it's as simple as that.
I want to talk about, because as you mentioned that there wasn't a huge difference for the West as well, and Constantine moved the capital to Constantinople. But I want to talk a little bit about the old capital, Rome, because it would slightly eventually become kind of irrelevant to the Roman Empire. It's my understanding that it wasn't really that important anymore. So what? Let's talk a little bit about Rome and how Rome would be after the Constantine moved the capital.
Okay. Yes. Rome. Well, for a start, everybody accepted the symbolic primacy of Rome as the city of the empire. And indeed, everybody called themselves Romans. The people who eventually rule from Constantinople, the people that we call the Byzantines. Byzantine is just a modern term of convenience. It was hardly used at the time. Byzantine derives from the old name of Constantinople, which before Constantine refounded it as Constantinopolis, was called Byzantion. So we call the people in the east the Byzantines, but they called themselves the Romans.
Right. And if I may, didn't Constantine at first begin with Nueva Roma, that new Rome? That
yes.
was the real name for the capital as well.
Yes, no. I mean, the real name was Constantinopolis, but it was often referred to as a new Rome. The problem is Latin doesn't have a definite or indefinite article. So whether it's the new Rome or a new Rome is ambiguous in Latin. But Rome was, in terms of its prestige, I mean, Rome never lost that prestige. But in the 4th century, already in the 4th century, long before the Battle of Adrianople and the barbarian problems, it wasn't it was seldom used as an imperial residence. Emperors visited it, but the reason for that's quite straightforward. Emperors wanted to be up near the frontiers, because they wanted to be with their army, because the effective political force in the 4th century wasn't the Senate in Rome, which was essentially rather a symbolic, if highly prestigious body. The effective political force was the soldiery, which had been the effective political force in the 3rd century and had overturned many emperors. And it was crucial for emperors to be, you know, near their soldiery. So they spent their time in places like Trier, or they might winter in Milan, or Sirmium up on the Danube, or Antioch on the eastern frontier in Syria. Rome, symbolic, but not an effective centre of power. That didn't mean it was unimportant, and it didn't mean that emperors ignored it totally. I mean, they continued to put up impressive buildings there, increasingly churches, and they visited it on occasion, you know, for great sort of symbolic set pieces of their power.
Now, of course, you mentioned that it kind of slightly become not as important, but still it must have been quite a shock factor when the visitors did the sack of Rome in 401, though, so that seemed to be kind of a big factor of as well to contribute to the decline of the Roman Empire,
yes.
The sack of Rome in 401.
Oh, symbolically, in 410.
Yes.
Symbolically, the Gothic sack of Rome was a tremendous shock. I mean, in fact, Jerome, the church father Jerome, who was in Palestine at the time, he wrote thinking that that would be the end of Roman power. Which one can understand, you know, if Rome falls, doesn't the entire empire crumble? The reality, of course, was that Rome wasn't the key political center. And actually, the empire did not completely collapse with the fall of Rome. But symbolically, it was a hugely serious moment. I mean, Rome hadn't been sacked since the Gauls sacked it in the 4th century BC. So, you know, this was a big moment.
And, of course, it's not about the move, it's under 402, I believe, Emperor Honorius moved the court from Milan again and onto Ravenna, isn't that right? So, again, Rome get a new capital as well.
Yes. In 402, I mean, the normal, as I was saying earlier, emperors in the 4th century spent much of their time, they spent their time nearer the frontiers. And often Trier, which is just behind the Rhine in modern Germany, and Sirmium, which is on the Danube. But they also spent quite a lot of time, and often they wintered in Milan, because Milan actually had access both to the Rhine frontier and to the Danube frontier, so you could move from Milan in either direction. In 401, the Goths enter Italy. This is after their success at Adrianople in 378. And Milan suddenly seems like a rather dangerous place. So what the emperors do is they move to Ravenna. The reason they moved to Ravenna is that Ravenna was basically surrounded by swamps and had tremendous natural defences. And also Ravenna was, well, not quite on the coast, but very, very near the coast. So it could easily be provisioned from outside and had very good links, for instance, to the Eastern Empire. So, yes, I mean, Ravenna is a new imperial residence in the 5th century.
Would it remain so until the end in 476, or would it just keep on moving capital?
No. Ravenna is the normal residence place of the emperors until 476, the deposition of the last emperor. And then, actually, crucially, it is the capital of Ostrogothic Italy under Theodoric. And in fact, one of its great moments is actually early 6th century, after the fall of the empire under the new Ostrogothic kings of Italy. And then when Justinian reconquers Italy, the imperial administration of Italy is then based in Ravenna. So Ravenna goes on being important, actually, right the way into the 8th century, when it's finally captured by the Lombards and declines. I mean, one of the reasons why, if you go to Ravenna, and if you've not been to Ravenna, do go to Ravenna, because it's fantastic, because it has all these buildings built in the 5th, 6th, 7th century, and they're not much touched. And the reason they're not much touched is because actually, after the 8th century, Ravenna became a very unimportant place. So all these buildings which had been put up were not then transformed in later centuries. So if you want to see a late Roman city, and particularly late Roman church, art and architecture, I mean, Ravenna is the place to go. I mean, much better than anywhere in the East, because in the East, in the 8th century, you have iconoclasm when they destroy all the images. Ooh. So, I mean, Ravenna has by far the richest collection of mosaics of any city.
So now, of course, I want to turn our noses towards North Africa. Of course, another thing that happened there in 429 is, of course, the Vandal invasion and the loss of Africa is beginning. So let's talk about the loss. And was it that important at the time for Rome? The loss of Africa was just a kind of thorn in the side at this point, that it was not that important.
I mean, the end of the Western Roman Empire is quite unlike any kind of modern invasion. I mean, modern invasions, you know, the tanks advance, you conquer territory, everything behind you is controlled by you, everything in front of you isn't controlled by you. I mean, the reality of the 5th century is that you've got imperial armies, you've sometimes got rival emperors fighting civil wars amongst the emperors. You've got a series of different peoples, people like the Goths, the Vandals, the Huns, all of whom fight each other just as much
as
they
fight. And
by
the way, if I may, we're not talking about the Goths that hang out in camp. There's a different kind of Goths.
Yes. Oh, yes. No, there are multiple peoples. They are far from united. And they fight each other just as much as they fight the Romans. And the Romans fight each other. As I say, there are, you know, the rival emperors. So it's a process of very gradual disintegration of Roman power and of more and more power slipping into the hands of Germanic peoples until eventually you get the final deposition of Romulus Augustulus in 476 and the effective end of all Roman rule. Although actually, little bits of the empire remain unconquered. I mean, in particular, West Britain, Wales, is never conquered by the Germanic people, at least not till the 13th century, when Edward I of England conquers it. And places like Brittany in Gaul, again, not really touched. So it's a very complicated process of sort of civil war disintegration and loss of Roman power. The loss of Africa was very important because Africa, until the Vandals conquer it in the 430s, was untouched by Germanic invasion because of the Straits of Gibraltar. And so it was the one area of the Western Empire that was really unaffected. And crucially, that meant that it could provide a tax base and therefore support the military machine of the remaining Roman of Roman power.
Where Egypt still the breadbasket of the Rome, or was it
Yes,
still
but
the
Egypt was in the Eastern Empire. So it wasn't supplying tax and revenue to the West. No, the breadbasket of the Western Roman Empire was Africa through Carthage, which is near modern Tunis.
You mentioned Britain, and I want to talk about the loss of Britain as well, of course, because eventually they followed the power, and Mark Morris write about this in and the consequences. We're going to talk about the consequences as well in a little in the short shortly. But the loss when the Romans lost Britain, according to Mark Morris, it was no circulation of coins, and there was total disarray in Britain because it was when you could not pay. Through the coins that circulated into the British Isles, there was total chaos, and it kind of what we would call, and of course the term is disputed now, but it was kind of a dark age in a sense after the loss of the Roman Empire, that British colony to the Roman Empire, and when they lost it.
Yes, no, I mean this is really where people disagree more even than over why the empire fell. What was the consequences of it? And I've written a book called The Fall of Rome and the End of Civilization. I am very careful to define civilization as society maintaining a complex economy, and all the things that go with a complex economy, like city life, literacy, coinage. Because I think that actually what happens with the end of the Roman Empire is a really dramatic decline in living standards, right the way across society, from sort of peasants up to kings in the West. I mean, Britain is the most extreme case. In Britain, in the 5th century, as you mentioned, coinage disappears, cities disappear. There are no cities in the late 5th century in
And of
Britain.
course, if I may, the roads, of course, are not maintained properly.
Ah, now roads actually have slightly more durability because they're very solid, and you, in a sense, can't destroy them. So, actually, one of the few things in Roman Britain that persists into the modern era, I mean, quite a few of the roads of modern Britain actually follow the Roman roads, are actually the Roman roads.
Really?
No, absolutely. But what also goes, for instance, is in Roman Britain, there were complex industries. We know most about it from pottery. There were industries that made wheel-turned pots and distributed them quite widely. And we know about that because pottery survives extremely well archaeologically. It's almost impossible to destroy. And you can date pots because they change, the types of pot change through time. And you can also provenance pots. You can know where they're made because, again, particular types can be identified as made in particular places. And if there's any doubt about that, you can actually do petrological analysis of it, look at the clay and see what the inclusions are in the clay in the pot, which will then place it geographically as where it was made. So pottery, we know an enormous amount. And late Roman Britain, 3rd, 4th century Britain, had a number of sizable pottery industries making very ordinary things, which were available way down society. I mean, not just for the elite. All of that just goes in the 5th century. There is, in fact, it's an extraordinary fact, but indisputable. There's no wheel-turned pottery made in Britain by the middle of the 5th century. The use of the potter's wheel, which is a really basic technology disappears from Britain. So you've got all the complex industries go, coinage goes, towns go, and you've also got a huge change in society because what was a single state breaks down into small kingdoms, and increasingly, in fact, small kingdoms ruled from hilltop fortresses. What happens is people reoccupy the old Iron Age fortresses. You, in a sense, revert to a pre-Roman sort of politics. And very, very importantly, the aristocracy, which in the Roman period was demilitarized, Roman aristocrats did not fight unless they chose to. In the 5th, 6th century, in places like Britain, aristocrats all become militarized. I mean, the sort of aristocracies we're used to in the Middle Ages. Now, Britain is a very extreme case, but the same sort of thing happens to lesser extreme right the way over the West. I mean, there are fewer towns by 600 in the West. There is far less coinage. There's far less complex industry. So there is a general, well, if you want to say simplification of the economy and society, you can, but I think you can call it a decline of the economy and a consequent change in society. I mean, one of the things that unquestionably happens in the 5th, 6th century all over the West is the aristocracy has to become militarized, which is a huge change. And essentially, you move to the sort of situation we're then used to right the way through the Middle Ages up until the 16th century. I mean, it's only really in the 16th century that, you know, aristocrats are not expected to be, and even then they are to some extent, you know, still expected to be military thugs. So it's a
You
huge change.
mentioned that, of course, Britain was a very extreme case, but when the Vandals invaded North Africa, which we spoke a little bit earlier about, was the kind of similar theme going on there in North Africa after the loss of Roman Britain, or was it different?
I think that there's certainly it's on the peripheries of the on the peripheries of the empire that the biggest changes happen. Really, actually, I mean, arguably, in the 5th century, in places like Italy and Africa, the Germanic invaders, what they want to do is they want to have a good time, and they don't really disrupt what's going on. But what happens is through the 5th, 6th century, there's a slow decline of the economy. And also, I think the militarization of the aristocracy is a much, much slower process. No, Britain is a very, very extreme case.
Is it more simply because it's an island that it's kind of isolated from the rest of Europe? Is that why it's so such an
It's a good, it's a
and
very good
extreme
question.
case?
Quite why is impossible, and I don't know is a simple answer, and I don't think anybody knows. I think it might be that the disruption in Britain is particularly extreme because what happens in Britain is, A, the Britons break down into little individual kingdoms, really quite small individual kings, and you've also got people from the north, the people who are called the Picts, coming in from what's now Scotland over Hadrian's Wall. You've got people coming over from Ireland, attacking the west of Britain. And for instance, you know, it's them who take prisoner a man called Patrick in the 5th century, take him over to Ireland. And Patrick is a Christian and, in fact, begins the conversion of Ireland. So that's, you know, a very important moment. And then also, of course, you've got people coming from modern Denmark and North Germany and even from Scandinavia, who we call the Anglo-Saxons. So there is an awful lot of disruption in Britain. I think it's probably exceptionally disrupted.
How quickly after the fall of Rome in Britain does the Anglo-Saxon arrive? Is it a few centuries? Is it almost immediately after the Romans leave?
Much discussed because our textual evidence is very, 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 very thin. I mean, basically, between 410, when the Emperor Honorius issues a law which affects Britain, and 597, when a missionary from Rome called Augustine arrives, we don't actually have any known dates in the history of Britain. Britain sort of slips into being sort of semi-prehistoric. So we're dependent almost entirely on archaeology, and the archaeological evidence, you can't really put very precise dates on pieces of pot. You can date them to, I don't know, 30, 40 years, but and say, trying to write military history from archaeology is pretty much impossible. And people have, they dispute it. I mean, there was an idea, which is probably true, that some of the Anglo-Saxons were already in Britain because they were there as mercenaries fighting in the Roman army. So in a sense, when in the 5th century things start to go terribly wrong, there are already people there, Germanic people from the continent. But they're certainly arriving in the early 5th century. And certainly the Irish are invading in the 5th century, and the Picts are unquestionably. I mean, in fact, there's a massive Pictish invasion in the 4th century, which is driven back.
It's not any of the facts that I wouldn't bring up because, as you know, of course, Rome was a very much slave state in its
Yes.
own right, and they were run by, not maybe not run by slaves, but slaves were a huge factor under the retribution. So, with a loss of territory, and of course, we mentioned Christianity, but that, as Christianity later, almost in the early Middle Ages, of course, it would translate into serfdom. But how did it? Did it begin to lose slavery and the kidnapping of slaves, turning into slaves when loss of territory began to be smaller as we see the Romans lose power? How is the slave trade and slave slavery a factor as well that when the loss of territories?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, because it is possible to argue that the Germanic invasions, lead to a more free society. It may be economically depressed, but lots of, free Germanic peasants who are, all very happy in their freedom, even though they may be economically rather low down the scale. The problem is, there's plenty of evidence for slavery in Germanic societies as well. I mean, people get captured and sold. They get sold. I mean, and in fact, slavery continues in the, post-Roman world. I mean, famously, Gregory the Great, Pope in Rome at the end of the 6th century, supposedly, one of the things that makes him want to convert the Angles, the English, is that he meets some Angle slaves in the slave market in Rome. And these have been captured by people in by Anglos other Anglo-Saxons and sold abroad. He meets some of these in the slave market, and they're charming, nice, blonde Anglo-Saxons, and he asks, "Who are these people?" And the answer is, "They are Angles, Angli." And Gregory looks at them and says, "Not Angles, but angels." And he decides that he's got to convert these people. So slavery doesn't disappear with the end of the Roman Empire. I mean, there are plenty of slaves in Germanic lands as well as in Roman lands. It's impossible to quantify. And actually, the great period of slavery in the Roman Empire was probably earlier than the late Roman Empire. What had probably happened by the late Roman Empire is that peasants, for instance, huge slave estates operated just by slaves, had probably changed into estates where you have people closer to what we would call serfs. And I think, I mean, the definition of a serf is that you can't actually sell a serf. You could in Russia in the 19th century, but I don't, you couldn't normally in the Middle Ages actually sell their bodies to somebody else, which you can with a slave. But
It's kind of a gray area in slavery in life,
yes,
basically.
they're tied to the land, forced to stay on the land with very bad deal in terms of, you know, what they could do. And for instance, they would be forced to, if they wanted to turn their grain into corn, they'd be forced to use the Lord's mill, and the Lord would give them a really bad deal on it. So they're to define them as half free is a useful definition. But we don't really have terribly good evidence from the immediately post-Roman period, you know, about things like that. It's really only later that we get detail about that kind of thing.
Of course, some people seem to contribute lead as a factor as well to the fall of the Roman Empire. So, is the truth that lead is a contributing factor?
Sorry, did you say lead?
Lead, yeah.
Lead poisoning, which is using lead in water supply, is thought to be a bad thing. It's unfashionable, this. I think mainly because I don't think it's been proved. And I suspect that these days you could probably prove it from skeletal evidence. I don't know. It's only gone out as an idea. And I think the main problem with the lead poisoning theory through is that what tends to happen with lead pipes is that they fur up inside enough to actually mean that the water is not really in contact with the lead. It's in contact with what the sort of furring up inside the pipe is like. So I don't think it is. It's certainly not a, it's not a fashionable view. I mean, of course, people will go on discussing all kinds of things. I mean, climate change is, you know, currently quite a big view. But that doesn't really work, because the problem about climate change is it would probably benefit some areas and disadvantage other areas. So it's a sort of climate change that affected the whole of the Western Roman Empire at once is implausible.
So, of course, another fellow that I want to discuss, and of course, I mentioned the Huns earlier and the Hun that you mentioned, but that arguably one of the most famous Huns, of course, is Attila the Hun. So let's
Yes.
discuss his contributing factor to the decline of Rome as well.
Yes, well, the Huns, the Huns certainly are responsible for disrupting the Germanic world north of the Danube at the end of the 4th century. We know this for certain, because the Roman historian Ammianus Marcellinus tells us explicitly that what drove the Goths over the Danube was the fact that the Huns were coming from the east and were conquering them. So that is certainly a factor. It is quite likely that they were also responsible for disrupting the Germanic world a bit later, in the early 5th century, further west, when in 407, a constellation of people, including the Vandals, cross the Rhine. They may well have been driven by Hunnic pressure. That we just don't know, because the texts don't exist to tell us that. Because one of the problems is that the minute you cross the Rhine or cross the Danube, going east over the Rhine or north over the Danube, you are entering prehistoric societies. They're not writing things down. They don't have histories. So in a sense, one is sort of guessing what's going on. It's quite likely, though, that the Huns are a major reason for the disruption of the Germanic world, which leads to the Germanic people to cross the Rhine. But certainly the Danube, in the case of the Goths, possibly, and indeed, I would say probably, but we can't prove it, the Rhine. at the beginning of the 5th century. Ironically, in the first half of the 5th century, the Huns are arguably something of a unifying force because they control almost everything east of the Rhine and north of the Danube. And as long as the Roman emperors paid them huge sums of money, they kept relatively quiet. And in fact, ironically,
it was kind of a mafia style, and says, "You pay us, we protect you."
Yes, I mean, it was like, I mean, it's, I suppose it's a little bit like the, you know, the Cold War, when you had, you know, the Soviet bloc and the Western world, and everybody sort of knew where everybody stood. And actually, that was reasonably, I mean, arguably, you know, with the disintegration, you know, of the Soviet bloc, things get more complicated. And it's only when the Hunnic Empire collapses after the death of Attila in the 450s and 460s. And in fact, after that, arguably, things get more chaotic. I mean, ironically, the Huns probably actually held things together. Because they were then paid off, as you say, in sort of mafia style protection money paid by the Roman Emperor.
And I want to talk about that again, bring back Christianization, because of course, it seemed to me that, of course, with Attila the Hun, the Germanic people were started to emigrate into the Roman Empire because of the pressure of Hunnic, as we briefly discussed, I think, but they were actually being Christianized as well, the Germanic tribes. I believe that came in and eventually would sack Rome in 476. I believe most they were starting to be Christianized as well in the Germanic tribes.
Yes, no, the Germanic tribes, with a few exceptions, the Anglo-Saxons are the obvious one. The Anglo-Saxons do not convert when they settle inside the empire. They're only converted when Rome sends missionaries to them at the very end of the 6th century. But for the most part, the Germanic people, when they enter the empire, or even before they enter the empire, have converted to Christianity. And it is definitely a factor that's important in terms of what happens, that the Germanic people enter the empire wanting to enjoy life within the empire. They don't come with any ideology of change or any ideology of wanting to impose Germanicness on the people they have settled amongst. If anything, they come with an ideology of wanting to benefit from what they found within the empire, which was more sophisticated, more complex than what they were used to before. So, in fact, they, when they come in as conquerors, but they also come in as sort of willing immigrants, and they do convert. And in time, most of them adopt the local language, so that, you know, French, Italian, Spanish, Portuguese are all forms of late Latin. Now, they're not, as it were, the language of the people who came in and conquered. They're the language of the indigenous people.
But because, of course, as well,
I mean, there were more of, I mean, the only place, in fact, where the language, sorry, the only place, substantial place where the language changes is probably in the Balkans, where eventually you get, you know, Slavic languages, although Romanians still speak a Romance language, and Britain, where, you know, Anglo-Saxon is, sorry, Anglo-Saxon becomes English, and we speak a Germanic language.
Now, of course, as with the case in many today's when we see immigrants coming in to our country, there's a lot of people that didn't like it. And of course, back then as well, there were a lot of people that didn't like that the Germanic tribes came in. And it's my understanding that they eventually tried to blockade the immigration from the Germanic class. So, of course, not all favoured immigration as well.
Oh,
as well,
yes, no. I don't think it was very, it wasn't benign immigration. And the simple truth is, Well, it's difficult to know what happens at a peasant level, but at an aristocratic level, the people who come in take a large share of the wealth, not all of it. They leave local people in power because it's convenient. They leave the church untouched, but they do take a very large share of the wealth. Quite how much is impossible to tell. And also, they take most of the power. I mean, all the Germanic people, probably even the Anglo-Saxons, although we don't know this, used local administrators, used local aristocrats, to run things. We know most about this in Italy, where, the senatorial aristocracy, in fact, under the Goths, under the Ostrogoths, under Theodoric in the 6th century, they kind of sort of ally, the senatorial aristocracy and the Goths are in sort of in an alliance. But when it comes to it, it's the Gothic king, Theodoric, who actually exercises power. It's not a Roman anymore. Theodoric, though, is proud to be heavily Romanized. He uses Latin in his administration. He uses Roman administrators. He lives in a marble palace in Ravenna. He's a Christian. For many Christians, he's the wrong type of Christian, but I mean, he's very, very Christian king. So, I mean, the Germanic people are actually attempting to fit in. But the reality is that they've taken quite a lot, and that is undeniable.
I want to jump back to Theodoric in just a brief second, but before we go to the final sack of Rome, I want to talk a little bit about the Roman army in the late 4th, 5th century as well, because, of course, as you know, the Romans army were backbones basically of the Roman Empire. But what was the state of the Roman army at the mid 5th century and leading up to the final sack of Rome?
Okay, well, it's a very good question. The simple truth is we don't really know. What we can say with confidence is that by the mid 5th century, the amount of territory that is controlled directly by the Roman emperors has shrunk dramatically. They've lost Africa, they've lost Britain, they've lost much of Spain, they've lost much of Gaul. So therefore, their tax revenue is tiny in comparison to what it was before. So their ability to pay for an army was hugely decreased. It's certainly also true that actually when they fought with barbarians, they allied with one lot of barbarians against another lot of barbarians, and so probably barbarian armies and Roman armies are starting to look really very similar, but it's almost certainly a very slow process, and frankly we just don't really know. I mean, do they still have, I don't know, can they still form a testudo in the old Roman fashion? And probably not. And certainly, the Germanic people, for instance, are learning to do things like siege warfare. So actually, by the 5th century, probably there's not a huge difference between a Roman army and a Germanic force. But we just don't know.
I'm fairly certain you didn't have 25 years of service anymore.
No. Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But also
So,
increasingly, the local provincials are militarizing themselves. They're moving more to a what one could call a medieval type society in which aristocrats fight, and they fight because they have to. And also, in a sense, the ethos of fighting, starts to enter. We know a little bit about this from Gaul, where we do know about, aristocrats who raised forces and fought, which would be unthinkable in the, I don't know, 2nd century. But they're gradually becoming militarized.
Is the idea of a standing army at this point start to fell fall, but there is no more standing
Yes, no, I mean,
army.
oh, definitely. The idea of a professional army is in slow decline. And by the 6th century, you don't have professional armies. What you have is you have people who owe military service.
Mercenaries.
No, not mercenaries. No, it's landowners, as you were, who, are expected to fight, very much like the Middle Ages. I mean, you.
It's interesting that after this part of history, you won't have another standing army until the Ottomans come to power and create the Janissaries. And this takes almost 5, 6, 7 centuries. On the top of my head, that until you get another standing army in Europe and in the almost in
Oh no,
the into
absolutely.
what
No,
this part.
standing armies. Standing armies go out. I mean, that's not to say that there weren't professional soldiers. I mean, all states, I think, would maintain a small corps, of people, bodyguards, for instance, who would be, absolutely crucial. But no, you're right. I mean, no, standing professional armies definitely go out. They are not a feature of the Middle Ages.
Now, before we go into the attack of the Theodoric, of course, and the final sack of Rome, I want to talk a little bit about the role of the emperor that he would play in the later half until, of course, Romulus Augustus. And I want to talk a little bit about how much power they actually wielded in the Western, because I've just spoke about the real power at this point, they mostly in Constantinople. But what about the Western emperors? How much power did they really have over their domains?
It's a very good question. And the reality is that increasingly power was held by their military commanders. And in fact, increasingly, those military commanders were themselves Germanic people. I mean, the most famous was Stilicho at the beginning of the 5th century, and then later a man called Aetius. And they effectively start. So, in fact, when one's talking about Romans fighting against Germanic barbarians, one is often talking about people who are Germanic, who are serving a Roman emperor, but actually largely controlling that emperor, fighting other Germanic people. I mean, the fifth
So
century is wonderfully
they're basically
chaotic.
a puppet row at this point. The Western emperor was basically a puppet of the
Yes,
Germanic clans.
it goes up and down a bit, but yes, increasingly. Yeah. He doesn't really matter. So when in 476 they Odoacer, the effective Germanic ruler, decides to ex to depose Romulus Augustulus, nothing really changes. It's all changed.
I want to talk a little bit about him because it's kind of a myth that he actually was named Romulus Augustus. Is that later to contribute to the fact that, oh, the last Roman emperor was called Romulus Augustus in kind of a poetic way that both the founder of Rome was Romulus and, of course, the first Roman emperor was Augustus. So was it kind of a myth that he was actually named Romulus Augustus to put on
I'm
kind of
afraid
a
I don't think I actually know. And I'm sure the Augustulus would not be his own name. Augustus doesn't mean little Augustus. I'm sure that would be a nickname imposed on him because of his powerlessness. But I'm afraid I don't actually know.
Because it's kind of sound like it should be more of a myth in the making that they were the
Yes,
last
no,
Roman emperor.
it does sound much too good to be true, but I cannot, I'm afraid. Afraid to debunk that for you because I really just don't know.
So let's talk about, of course, we mentioned him earlier, but let's talk about the final sack of Rome and Theodoric's entry into Rome. And as we spoke about, he was really keen on being a Roman himself. And of course, So let's talk about the final sack of Rome,
No,
if that they
I'm
call
going
it.
to correct you. There is no
Yeah.
sack of Rome. There are two
Thank you.
sacks of Rome. One of them is 410, which is the Goths, which is this terrible shock. And the other one is 455, which is the Vandals. The Vandals come from Africa by sea and they sack Rome. And arguably the Vandal sack is worse than the Gothic sack. The end of in 476, really nothing happens. Romulus Augustulus is deposed and that's it. There is no event. It's just that's all that happens.
So when they were, but the, it's my understanding as well that when, like you said, a lot happened, but they didn't stop thinking of themselves as the Roman. I know, we're Italian now, we speak Italian, and we make you know, they didn't think of themselves as immediate, oh, we're not Roman anymore, and we're from now on, we are Italians. Of course, that wouldn't be seen until the 19th
Oh,
century,
sorry. Oh, sorry. No,
but
absolutely
they
true.
still.
Yeah, no, sorry. Odoacer and his successor Theodoric are proudly Romanizing. One of the problems, though, is what we have is that we have the propaganda presentation of themselves as very, very Roman, which is produced for a Roman audience so that the Roman audience thinks that really nothing has changed. Whether, for instance, Theodoric in 6th century Ravenna, who certainly lived in a marble palace in a completely Roman style, whether he actually spoke Latin, all his administration is in Latin, whether he spoke Gothic or whether his counselors had to speak Gothic, we just don't know. I mean, probably the reality is that they're presenting themselves as even more Roman than they were. But you're quite right, they're trying to fit in. And in fact, early 6th century Ravenna is a sort of golden age of Ravenna in terms of its, mosaics, its churches, its sort of Roman style.
Did the Eastern Roman emperors care at all about what happened over there in 476? It just that doesn't
But
matter.
no, the truth is they did, and periodically they sent. There's an attempt to recapture Carthage, for instance, in the 5th century, with a major force coming from the east. And then, very importantly, in the 6th century, in the 530s and 540s, Justinian reconquers Africa very successfully, and much.
No, just for like 5 seconds.
Sorry?
Just for like 5 second time.
No, Africa remains in East Roman hands until the Arabs conquer it, and that's only in the late 7th century. No, it's quite a long time. He also conquers bits of Spain, which is held for about 100 years, and crucially, he conquers Italy, and large parts of Italy remain in Byzantine hands. And well, in the north, Ravenna is finally captured by Lombards in the mid 8th century. But in the south, Sicily is held by the East Roman Empire until the Arabs conquer it in the 9th century. And what is now Puglia, the sort of heel of Italy, is in Byzantine hands until the 11th century when it's conquered by the Normans. So there is actually quite a.
I do believe that some historians is currently that on Justinian is currently debating, but if it actually was a good idea, but if it did more harm than good with Belisarius conquering of Italy and that part of
Yeah.
the empire, because it seemed to be kind of mixed thoughts there. If it was more harmful than actually good, of
Yes,
the consequences.
that is much debated. I think one could probably reasonably say that's for another of your podcasts.
Indeed.
You could perfectly well have a podcast on Justinian.
Of
Was he a good or
course.
bad thing for the East Roman
Yeah.
Empire?
I mean, he did get Hagia Sophia, so that's kind of
Oh yes. No. Justinian is
yeah.
certainly a very powerful, influential
Yeah.
person. Whether it's good or bad, I think would it's not. I'm not really an expert, and I think you'd need a different
Yeah.
podcast on that.
Of course, but let's go back to the West because I want to talk a little bit about the Latin language as well. How long does it stay in a verbal form until it dies out? And how is the death of the Latin language in the West? Because, of course, in the East, as we talked about, Justinian would be the last emperor to speak Latin, but the Greek was the main language in the East. But how did the death of Latin occur?
Oh, sorry, Latin never dies. Latin just slowly changes into Italian, Spanish, and French. I mean, those are all basically just late Latin. It's the
I mean, the Latin, as we know from Roman, in like how
well,
quickly does it,
it's very,
no.
very difficult to tell. But I mean, the problem is, as you will know from English, the way we spell things in English and the way we pronounce them does not have a very close relationship to each other. So, what happens is that, people continued to write when they were talking about a dog, they would write canis, Latin dog. But probably in what is now France, in Gaul, slowly the pronunciation would change to something closer to chien. I mean, chien, Chien, is definitely, it's the same word as canis, but it's now, spelt different and pronounced different. But probably it gradually was pronounced different. Whereas in Italy, they were continuing to say something closer to cane. In Spain, of course, they do something totally different and they go over to perros, which has no relationship at all. But it's probably a very, 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 very slow change. And we can't really document it because the written language remains, formal Latin. I mean, you can document it up to a point because, for example, a lot of writers really, I mean, they in Latin, because Latin is an inflected language where you can tell whether somebody is the subject or the accusative. So you could put king kills bishop, and by the way you change the ending of the word, it could be the bishop who kills the king or the king who kills the bishop, depending on the ending of the word, not the word order. Increasingly, people write with things in the word order that we're used to. So it would be the king killed the bishop, would always be king kills bishop, not bishop killed king, which so you need an inflected line. So you can sort of tell that they're using the ends. I mean, they're not inflecting so much, which is a move towards modern languages. So, I mean, there are ways of sort of seeing, but Latin doesn't die. It just changes. And of course, as a language of communication and education and administration, I mean, it's right up to the 17th century. I mean, the 17th century, I mean, people like Newton can communicate with people on the continent in Latin, no problem at all. And actually, the 18th century arguably is disastrous because people stop having a common language of communication. I mean, nowadays, English is gradually becoming one again, but for educated people, and you could be, you went as a in the 13th century, you went from England to, I don't know, Padua to study, no problem at all, because it's all done in Latin, and that's done in proper Latin. I mean, that's they're communicating in proper Latin. So, no, Latin has it doesn't it continues as the language of education, administration, and at a lower level, it just slowly changes into modern languages.
Now, of course, I want now you want to discuss some. It does just some of this already, like with Latin language, but I know you want to discuss some of the consequences for the Western Roman Empires and the aftermath of after the supposed fall in 476. That is not happened, but let's discuss anyway the consequences of the fall and how it, this will change basically
Okay.
Europe.
Well, I think actually, to be honest, I think we've mainly covered this because I would argue that there is a very substantial economic decline. And
Of course.
certainly, and as I've also said, there's a massive change in society towards a militarized aristocracy. And also, I mean, really very, very basic. The West Roman Empire becomes a series of different independent polities. And you get the breakup of the empire, which is a huge change. And those places, of course, develop in different ways. They develop different identities, so that you have Castilians, Provençal, French. All sorts of different th things happen as a result. I mean, that's not to say that within the Roman, if the Roman Empire had continued, everybody would have been absolutely the same. Far from it. But on the other hand, by the late empire, amongst the aristocracies, there's a strong sense of Romanness. And one of the things that does not bring down the empire is nationalism, local nationalism. I mean, there really is almost no evidence of people wanting to be, of, sorry, of aristocrats wanting to be free of the empire. There's evidence of slaves and suppressed people wanting to be free, but that's social rather than national. So no, I mean, the end of the Roman Empire is a massive change in terms of, the complete structure of politics and of society is transformed.
I mean, we discussed this earlier as well in this part about Britain, but I want to ask you as well that with the term Dark Ages, of course, as I said, it has been disputed by modern scholars as a term in today, but what do you think about the term Dark Ages used after the Roman Empire?
Well, it depends. For some places like Britain, I mean, you could mean use it just to say we don't really know. And in the case of Britain, as I say, there's no textual evidence for a couple of centuries. So, I mean, in that respect, you could say dark.
Of course, Bede is the basically our other source for
Yeah, I know,
those
but
era, isn't it?
Bede's writing in the 730s. That's actually 300 years later.
But still, he's kind of our only source on that era because he, in his history of the English people, he kind of it supposedly covers from Caesar's invasion until his time, doesn't he?
But sorry, on the subject of dark, I mean, one of the problems, it has connotations of moral darkness. I think those are definitely wrong. I don't know. And I mean, you're right. It's gone out of fashion.
Is it because people think that civilization was lost until basically the Renaissance era, and is that kind of part of it that the civilization is
Well, I mean,
supposedly lost?
I argue, and I argue in my book, that there's a dramatic economic decline, and that actually that economic decline, I don't think Western Europe reaches the levels of economic sophistication that you have in the Roman Empire until maybe the 10th, 11th century. I think there is a massive economic change, which I think it's hard not to see as an economic decline. I mean, just look at the archaeological evidence of, I mean, the Romans are absolutely everywhere, and they're there in obvious form. If you look for people from the 7th, 8th century, it's that you're struggling. You're finding, post holes, and, wooden structures. So, I mean, I do think there's a, I'm not sure I would call it the Dark Ages, but on the other hand, actually, in my book, I say the end of civilization. So probably, I'm probably actually at one extreme. I do sort of believe in Dark Ages. I wouldn't use the term because it's so unfashionable, but I do think something really quite dramatic happens at the end of the Roman Empire, and it leads to a huge economic regression. But other people would dispute that.
I think we got to round it up there. I hope you enjoyed this episode about the decline of Paul of the Roman Empire. Of course, before you go, you mentioned your book. Where can people buy your book if they want to read more about the decline of Paul and the consequences of the Roman Empire? And of course, do you have any social media or places where people can find you if they have any further questions that they want to know about this topic?
Okay, well, my book is still in print. It's published by Oxford University Press. It's a paperback. It's quite short. It's got pictures. It was deliberately written for a broad audience. So it's not, I mean, it's a serious book, but it is actually written for a wider audience. And in fact, I won a prize for its literary merit, and it's called
Ooh.
The Fall of Rome and the End of Civilization. But if you remember my name and you Google my name, you'll probably find it without too much difficulty. I mean, equally, my name is very distinctive. If you really want to get in touch, you won't have any problems finding some link to how to get in touch with me. And thank you all very much for listening. It's been fun to do. I'm currently working on a totally different project on the origin of the cult of Christian saints.
Ooh.
But it's been nice to go back to something that I wrote a book about. So thank you.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to have you on the podcast. This has been Well That Aged Well. We are available on social media on Instagram and Well That Aged Well, Twitter / X these days, and Well That Aged Well. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, wherever you can find podcasts these days. And if you are on Apple Podcasts, consider writing a little review and give us 5 stars. And also do the same, give us 5 stars. Or you can leave one if you hated this episode, which I hope you don't, on Spotify as well. Again, please like, share, and subscribe. My name's Alan, and I'll see you next time.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.